Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Sean Dugan of KTVA Channel 11, Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and from Fairbanks, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. We have a big show for you this week, focusing on two very important issues. First of all, the Ted Stevens case, as we now have an investigator's report at the behalf of the judge, Judge Emmett Sullivan, on the conduct of the prosecutors in the case, and reapportionment redistricting, which affects all Alaskans, and the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska ruled on the reapportionment board's approach. First of all, Judge Emmett Sullivan's investigator releases his report on the prosecutor's conduct in the conviction of Ted Stevens, our U.S. Senator, which was eventually thrown out. Sean, a lot to absorb in more than 500 pages between yesterday and today, but what can you tell us?
Well, I can tell you that when I tried to print it out to bring it in this morning to use as a visual aid, it actually broke my printer. It's a lot of pages, as you mentioned. A lot of it's not new information. You know, we've been waiting for this report, but parts of it have been leaked out before. Some of the interesting parts address what the judge Emmett Sullivan believes, or the investigator Henry Schulke believes, the prosecution failed to turn over to the defense. Now, of course, the rules are different in federal court than they are in state court. In state court, the prosecution has to turn over everything. Federal court, the prosecutors get some leeway there, and it appears they may have overstepped that. The report is really critical of their decisions not to turn over evidence that the star witness in the case, Bill Allen, lied about a sexual relationship allegedly with a 15-year-old prostitute, Bambi Tyree. If you're from Alaska, you may remember her from the Joseph Boehm case, the former owner of AIH who was sentenced on crack cocaine charges and other sexual misconduct. But Bambi Tyree apparently, at least in the FBI's own files, told several agents that Bill Allen asked her to sign an affidavit saying she did not have sexual relations with him and that that was untrue. That was not turned over to the defense, and many people believe that could have been used to impeach Mr. Allen as far as a witness. The other part that's interesting is concerning one of the contractors that worked on the Stevens house. His name's Rocky Williams. He worked for Vico. I believe he was actually somehow related to Mr. Allen by marriage, a nephew.
Wasn't he superintendent on the Stevens repair job?
He was, and he was officially working for a subcontractor named Christensen Construction. And his testimony might have been exculpatory for Senator Stevens. That Senator Stevens had said he thought he was paying the bills. There was this note, a Torricelli note, they call it, because of its federal implications. But where Stevens had sent a note to one of his friends saying, you know, a friend was going to tell him how much it was. He wanted to take care of the bill. Of course, that's the famous note that Bill Allen said that Mr. Stevens was just trying to cover his backside on. But Mr. Williams' testimony could have backed up Senator Stevens, and that Rocky Williams, at least the construction foreman, believed that the senator was paying the bills. So will it change anybody's mind about what had happened? Probably not. Like many things in life, this is fairly polarizing, and I think that people have already made up their minds, and the ones that believed in Senator Stevens believe in him more today, and the ones that didn't believe in him before still don't. So
let's follow up on that, Tim. What, in your judgment, how's this being received here on the home front in Alaska?
Well, I think Alaskans are going to just feel outraged by this, because I mean, we have enough reasons to be mad at the federal government, and this is just one more. You know, we tend to trust the Department of Justice to be legal, to do things the right way, and this just reinforces a reputation that started with them, you know, a few years ago on this thing. So, I mean, I feel badly about this, and I think most Alaskans do.
And we feel
we've been damaged by this.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, Dermot, is there any way to know what would have transpired if Ted Stevens had all the information he was entitled to have from the prosecutors, and we had gone ahead with what could be called a fair trial?
Mike, you know, this happened at a certain point in time. I think we have no way of knowing for sure. I do think that the Stevens defense would have been stronger had the prosecution done its job and treated him fairly. The defense would have been stronger because of the information that really poked some holes in Bill Allen's story. Sean mentioned the so-called Torricelli note. And I thought that was particularly striking to me in this report, to read how a prosecutor believed that Stevens had gone back and forged, backdated that note 6 years and created it simply to cover himself. What became known generally in this document as the CYA note.
Well, maybe at this point you ought to tell us also about alligator arms.
Yes, this same prosecutor, Brenda Morris, believed that when Stevens wrote this note telling Bill Allen that he wanted a bill, saying that it was a question of gator arms, meaning you're at the table, but your arms and you feign that you want to grab the bill, but your arms are too short, like those of an alligator, to grab the bill. I wrote in my column that she was totally clueless about what Ted Stevens was like. There's no way he would have gone and been calculating enough to backdate a note like that 6 years, or to even do that. Just it runs totally counter to everything that people in Alaska who knew Stevens would say about him. They might accuse him of a lot of things, but he wouldn't have done that. And I'm just sort of struck by how uninformed a prosecutor could be about the character of a man that they're going after.
Well, I think I could just add here that many of us who dealt with Ted Stevens knew him to be blunt and direct and Starman Norman, if you like, at certain points. But devious is not one of the terms that comes to mind when you think of Ted Stevens. And perhaps in legislation from time to time, he notoriously was able to put things in bills, but that was in public matters. I don't know anybody who thought of him as devious in his personal life.
And certainly not in this way. I'm not sure who they thought they were dealing with, but they were not dealing with the Ted Stevens that Alaskans know. And he was fairly upfront with the way he felt about this case. He thought that he did nothing wrong. And I think, in fact, he may have gotten some gifts, the grill and the massage chair and the dog and the artwork, etc., that should have been reported. But to me, it looks like, had he received a paper clip and he had not reported it on the form, he would have been guilty, considered guilty in the eyes of the law on this, with this reporting requirement. The whole thing is a paperwork violation, as far as I'm concerned. And this report is very damning to the federal government and the Bush administration lawyers who handled this.
Sean, what will Ted Stevens' reputation be from now on?
Well, as I said, I don't know. It certainly would have been interesting to see how Senator Stevens would have received the news if he had been alive this long to actually get to this point. But as I said earlier, I honestly believe that this is one of those polarizing things where many people already had the belief that Senator Stevens didn't really do anything wrong. And I think this just backs that up. And those that believed he was receiving gifts, no matter how small or how large, will still believe that. But what it really does, and Dermot hit the nail on the head, and so did Mr. Bradner, is that it really kind of takes away the trust we have in the federal government, and that's something that we as Alaskans, I think, have always struggled with. And I think if there's a legacy to that, it will be that we struggle with it more.
Okay, Tim, does this have any implications for Mark Begich, our junior senator who defeated Ted Stevens in a few weeks after the conviction?
Michael, I don't think so. I think most people some time has passed, and Mark Begich is building his own reputation and track record, and I think people separate the two. I don't think there's any doubt that very difficult for Mark Begich to have defeated Ted Stevens had he not been convicted by the court and that had happened. But I don't think at this point, the report itself is clearly misconduct by the prosecutors and has no rub-off or
and
no spin-off on
as
Begich.
With the trial itself, there's right. No rerun here.
Right, and I don't think it really hurts Begich.
Any thoughts on Lisa Murkowski's legislation to standardize the practice of federal prosecutors in all districts of the country, which she unveiled yesterday?
Well, I think in the wake of this, I think something is needed.
Yeah, and it was very striking. The majority leader, Dick Durbin, is one of the supporters of this, so that ought to tell you something. He's a Democrat. Tim, let's stay with you. The latest on oil taxes and the debate over the same in Juneau. Switching gears here.
Michael, the legislators and particularly the Senate Finance Committee are hard at work right now grappling with what to do about this. The House, as you recall, passed a bill last year. The Senate did not pass it, did not accept it. The Senate is working on its own bill. There seems to be now a consensus, even among senators, that something needs to be done, that the present tax regime is too restrictive and will not allow new development. The consultants that the legislature has hired, PFC Energy, which has been testified the past few days, and Pedro Van Mieres, who was there earlier, seem to agree with us. So the senators are getting a lot of reinforcement that something has to happen, and I think they agree. The question is what and how
much? And also there's a question of, can they get the administration to accept what they might view as reasonable changes?
Well, that's true. And the administration, the governor has his own interpretation of what the code word is, meaningful tax changes, enough to give the incentives. Now, the two sides, what's at stake really here is how much money is involved. I mean, how much do you have to give back in the way of tax reductions to get the companies, to give them the incentive to go find more oil? And that's the real issue at stake here. The present Senate bill, which a lot of people know will be amended, only reduces taxes by something like $200 million, where the bill that the legislature, the House passed last year, the governor's bill, reduces taxes by about $1 billion or more, a little bit more. So there's a wide difference there. And if they split it in the middle, is that enough? Okay. We don't know.
Let's go back to Dermot Cole. Dermot, what stands out in your mind as you've listened to Tim here and observed what's going on in Juneau?
Well, I keep going back. Tim's right. The code word these days is meaningful tax change, as opposed to meaningless tax change, I guess. This, you have a difference of interpretation of what exactly meaningful means. And secondly, you have the question of what's the relationship between a tax change and an increase in investment. And that's still an unknown as far as, just about everybody can tell. Nobody can really pin that down as to what the exact relationship in it. What the relationship is there. For instance, for every dollar tax change, you get how much more in investment. There is a relationship, but I don't believe it's a direct one, and I don't believe it's simple to calculate. So that makes the political options more confusing and uncertain. So I'm not sure if they're going to get anything done in this session on this, if they're going to reach a consensus on this.
Let's get Tim Bradner in here very quickly.
Michael, I think Dermot's right. I mean, we're running out of time. We've got 3.5 weeks or so left to the end of the session, and it's going to be pretty tough to get this thing done. The companies have, in regard to the investments, the companies have said that they're looking at $5 billion in new projects that they could move forward fairly quickly if this bill passes. What the legislators are wrestling with is, well, okay, they do that, but how much are we going to give away in terms of tax reductions to get the $5 billion? So it's really all about money. How much does it take? What are you going to get? Are we really going to get the investment? Is it going to be more than we're reducing taxes?
And how much risk does the legislature want to take?
Right.
Okay, once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Tim Bradner, Sean Dugan, and Dermot Cole. Reapportionment. The Alaska State Supreme Court, here's the reapportionment case. One day this week, and by the next day, it says, fellas at the reapportionment board, redraw the lines. Sean, take us through the court's ruling.
Well, the Supreme Court ruled that the reapportionment board did not follow the proper procedure, at least in its estimation, that it should have drawn the lines to meet the Alaska Constitution. Now, it gets really complicated, but suffice it to say that the Alaska Constitution has a certain set of requirements, and then the Federal Voting Rights Act has another set of requirements that basically are in place to ensure that areas with a high native population don't get redistricted out of influence. And basically what the Supreme Court ruled the apportionment board did was look at the Constitution and come up with kind of a plan and then modify it to meet the Federal Voting Rights Act and then submit it. And the court said, really, that's not how we want you to do it. We need you to put this solely in the confines of what the Alaska Constitution wants to do, and then we'll take a look at that. Now, the implications for that, I'm sure Dermot can get into that and what it means for Fairbanks. Now, this is often a political process. reapportionment is always one of those things where the people that get put into the same districts complain that it's a political process, and who knows how much that is going to come into play. But basically, they have till April 2nd to submit new plans. Then the board can review them till the 13th, and then they'll all be back in court May 7th, I would imagine, to figure it all out.
Okay, Dermot, this case originated in Fairbanks. What can you tell us from the Fairbanks perspective?
Well, Mike, the two residents of the suburbs of Fairbanks really brought this case, saying they didn't think it was right that their house district would extend from just outside of the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus to the Bering Sea. And that question, that particular house district, was that house district was declared unconstitutional by the Superior Court, and that issue was not argued in the Supreme Court. So the rewriting of that particular or the redrawing of that particular district is something that has to take place now with the reapportionment board. This Supreme Court decision sets in motion a series of events that could ripple across the state and change many districts, change the boundaries of districts, not just in Fairbanks, but across a wide range of our state, perhaps down even to Anchorage. We don't know. The court did not rule on many of the specific items that were brought up related to Fairbanks. It dealt with one specific, and that was saying that the city of Fairbanks, or the population of the city of Fairbanks, could be argued that it deserves a Senate seat of its own. It did not say set boundaries or require that this happen. It just said that would be a legitimate legal argument to be brought up. One reason why this is important is that Senator Joe Pascoman and Senator Joe Thomas would have been in the same Senate district under the plan that has now been rejected by the Supreme Court. Will they be in the same Senate district with the next plan? That's an open question. We don't know. They may end up in different districts, and that would satisfy some and make others unhappy. My idea in this, I think the supercomputer at the University of Alaska Fairbanks should plug all the data into that and see what it spits out in terms of.
So your idea is you're going to put all the information in the supercomputer and then put in the word gerrymander and see what comes out.
No, it's like, you know, how do you?
You're going to put in the words good government.
Yeah, this is the Supreme Court decision quoted a previous Supreme Court decision saying that the task for the apportionment board is a Herculean task. That's probably true. It's easier though than it used to be in the old days because of the power of computers. They can now make these decisions and see what happens quite rapidly. It's easier than it used to be. It's still difficult to balance all these interests.
Okay, Dermot, I'm going to add something here because I went to the hearing this week, and Mr. White, who is the lawyer for the board, was at great pains to remind the judges numerous times, this is very difficult. This is very hard. It is. He didn't use the word Herculean, but it was lurking in his prose or his words. And then he said, if you knew how hard this was and you knew how hard we worked, you would agree with what we did. But my companion there, who'd worked on many reapportionment cases, said, that's what everybody says when this happens, and I've said it myself. He was a Democrat, I might add. We should note here one factual matter. Many people will note that the election, the date for filing for election is June 1st, and traditionally you have to have districts so people know what district they're in. It's been pointed out to me by a very smart lawyer who remembers these things better than I do, that on at least one previous occasion, the Supreme Court has intervened and said extended the date for candidate registration to allow the board and others to work out some of their differences. Tim, I want to get you back in here. What happens next?
Well, not really being an expert in these things, I think what clearly happens is we're almost back to going back to the board. You have a feeling we're back to ground zero, but maybe not quite. So the board has to reconvene, come up with a new map, resubmit it, and the whole thing starts all over again.
And Have you been in Juneau enough recently, or in the last month or whatever, to have a sense of, I assume the people down there are paying very close attention to this, our legislators?
Oh, they are. Well, certain legislators are certainly the ones who are affected, particularly the Fairbanks Senate districts.
Yeah.
I mean, that has big implications.
Have two Democrats, Democratic senators have to run again.
Can jump in here, and
please,
let's not forget, a lot of those, almost all the lawmakers are up for re-election because of the redistricting. Some of them weren't actually scheduled to be up for re-election, so we may not know who actually is going to have to run and who doesn't if this does, as Dermot says, has a ripple effect throughout certain areas of the state.
Stick with you, Sean. The U.S. Senate votes down a measure to open ANWR by a 57-41 vote. Tell us more.
Not surprising, frankly. It was a transportation bill. It was lumped in there with another effort to get the Keystone Pipeline started. So there were plenty of reasons for people maybe opposed to vote against it. But the Senate always seems to be the sticking point. I think it got through the Senate once. Now someone's going to correct me on the air.
But I think that's right, and I think it's 94.
94. Bill Clinton actually vetoed it. Now, Don Young's had much better luck in the House. I believe it's at least been up for a vote 20 times. It seems to me that ANWR is gaining steam. I mean, we've heard this before, but with the price of gas and the problems in the Middle East, if we're going to open ANWR ever, I would imagine that that it's going to happen, at least the votes will happen in the next decade or so. But you know, it's, and somebody my age in their 40s, ANWR's been on the hook since I can remember, and I really don't think this changes any of that.
To quote a famous uncle, Mars has never been closer.
Yes.
This is
big and
Tim,
red.
Tim, does this give us any future, any hints about the future of ANWR? Following up on what your colleague said.
You know, Michael, ANWR's this poster child. I mean, it's something Alaskans like to fight about and everything. And I don't know. I hope that after all this, if it's ever open, I hope there's some oil there. We really don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. We
deserve it after this, right?
Yeah. And actually, let's not forget that there are other places in the Arctic where people think there's a lot of oil, mainly the offshore, where Shell hopes to finally drill this year.
Let me stick with you. This is something I hadn't thought of. I mean, I've thought of it before, but I didn't think about it when I was putting together this show. I sort of wonder, my sense of the oil companies is their attitude is, if you can open the ANWR, great, but we're no longer going to go put a full court press on the Congress.
Well,
wrong?
What's interesting about this is the maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the major companies were actively supporting it. Now they're really, really hunkering down and out of sight on this. And one interpretation of that is if the feds open it up and they decide to have a lease sale, yeah, they're going to show up. And they, meantime, they just don't want to burn up a lot of political juice with fighting for this. They'll just leave it to the Alaskans. Industry has other fish to fry and more important things to do, in their view. So,
thank you. Let's go back to Dermot Cole. Dermot, and some legislators want to start now an advertising campaign to get ANWR open. Tell us about that in the state house.
Well, I have a hard time believing this is actually going to be approved, but the idea is that it's proposed by an Anchorage Republican legislator, by the way, that the state would split the cost of advertising with a pro-drilling group such as the Chamber of Commerce or the Alliance or maybe even AOGA. And there are all sorts of problems with this, the main one being they're talking about perhaps $1 million total, which in terms of advertising is not going to get you very far. Sean knows about TV advertising. You might ask him how far that might go nationally. This is not going to be decided in that manner. You need quite a few votes in the U.S. Senate, and you need a president who would be in favor of it. There's some huge political obstacles to this. I agree with Tim. The major oil companies, I think BP may sort of led the charge about 15 years ago, pulling back because they didn't want to cause themselves harm nationally by being too eager to go into ANWR. And I don't know that the companies have changed much from that, although I think it still is regarded as the best onshore prospect in the United States. It would be, but we also don't know for sure that there's any oil there either. He's right. So,
okay, let's go to Tim here. We're running out of time. Tim, can you give us an update on the gas line proposals and what we're hearing out of Juneau?
Well, the latest thing is very interesting. The companies are saying just this week in interviews in Juneau that they are making a lot of progress in talking among themselves to come up with a unified approach to a gas line. They say they will meet the governor's milestones of having an agreement and maybe support for an LNG export project by later this year. So that's encouraging. The caveat to this, though, is they say they do still want meaningful changes to the oil tax regime, because they point out that the gas line doesn't really work unless you've got a healthy oil business that pays the bills, pays the maintenance.
So making progress. But Dermot, very quickly, House Bill 9, what is it? Why does it matter?
Well, that is to basically empower a subsidiary of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to be what I have referred to as a super agency. I think it would almost make it the most powerful entity in state government, and it would basically be in charge of building or arranging to be built a bullet line from the North Slope to the Anchorage area. This, you know, I think it's favored by the Speaker of the House and by key leaders in the House. It's going to meet some stiff resistance in the Senate if it gets that far.
We're running into stiff resistance to the clock. We're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us here on Alaska Edition, and we'll see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.